Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved in 13 cities and 218 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by Dr. Garth Graham from the Department of Health and Human Services. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about telephone helplines designed to provide healthcare triage services around the world. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Mark Maselli.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
This week's bright idea focuses on an initiative that uses a strategic public health approach to violence prevention. Ceasefire has its roots in Chicago, where youth violence is often referred to as an epidemic. Last year, nearly 700 children were hit by gunfire, an average of almost two a day. So in 2000, when the program was launched by the Chicago Project for Violence Prevention, violence began to be treated as a public health crisis instead of merely a crime problem. Ceasefire uses public education campaigns, GED programs, and various counseling opportunities to target violence. But its main tool is community mobilization. Trained volunteers from the community, called violence interrupters, establish a rapport with gang leaders and other at-risk youth, just like outreach workers would in a public health campaign. Many interrupters are from the communities they serve, and many are former criminals who know violence firsthand. The interrupters work the streets, helping to keep minor arguments from becoming deadly and mediating more aggressive ones between gangs. After a shooting, they intervene with nonviolent alternatives to stop the victim's friends and family from retaliating. The program has produced encouraging results. The U.S. Department of Justice conducted a three-year evaluation in 8 of 18 Chicago communities where ceasefire has been adopted. Shooting and killings have been reduced by 41% to 73%, and retaliatory killings by 100% in 5 of the communities. The model has been replicated more than a dozen times nationally. A public health approach to stopping violence with hard statistics to back it up. Now that's a bright idea. Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Garth Graham, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. The Office of Minority Health within HHS develops and coordinates federal policy to make sure that all levels of government, federal, state, and local, are addressing the needs of racial and ethnic populations. Welcome, Dr. Graham.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
The Office of Minority Health was created in 1986 and came out of Secretary Heckler, then President Reagan's Secretary of Health and Human Services Task Force on Minority Health. Yet health disparities continue today, even though many people know very little bit about such disparities in the United States. Can you start out by telling us about the Office of Minority Health?
Sure. As you pointed out, Mark, our office was created as a result of something called the Secretary's Task Force on Black and Minority Health, which was issued back in the mid-80s and actually was the first federal document to really document this issue of health disparities and spawned a lot of different activities both here at HHS but in a number of states across the country and started up the health disparities research activities over at NIH as well. So really kind of spawned, or really helped to elevate this health disparities movement. Our office has been charged over the years with coordinating all the policies across HHS. And HHS, when I say HHS, I mean the Food and Drug Administration, CDC, NIH, as well as the Health Resources and Services Administration and a whole bunch of other agencies. So coordinating much of those policies, but we also work with states, and over the years have helped to support and create a number of state offices of minority health that also exist at the state and local level. So It's been a journey so far in terms of the role and the responsibilities of this office, but certainly an exciting journey so far, and a lot under the Affordable Care Act having to do with our office as well.
So, Dr. Graham, I'd like to step back in time a little bit, even before the Office of Minority Health was established, and go back to the civil rights movement of the late 50s and 60s. And certainly the Reverend Martin Luther King spoke eloquently to the issue of disparity, saying of all the forms of inequality, injustice in health was the most shocking and the most inhumane. Can you give us perhaps a bit of a historical perspective on how federal policy has affected health and healthcare for minority groups in the U.S. over these past 50 years?
There are a number of important things that happened in the 1960s. Up until that time, minorities were quite frankly receiving care that was only, where people would only be physically located in one section of the hospital and be seen by only one set of clinicians as well as healthcare services. So you're right in really articulating that this issue goes way, way back before the Secretary's Task Force on Black and Minority Health. So Martin Luther King articulated things well in terms of highlighting just how important this issue of health and healthcare is to the health, to not only the health of a community, but the future of a community. So what you saw from the late 1950s and 1960s and on was first a desegregation of healthcare for minority populations, which was a big move back in the mid-1960s. In the 1970s, there was a Surgeon General report that also articulated much in terms of the disproportionate burden of illnesses that minority communities face. So there was a lot of different, not only reports, but activities. Interestingly now, when you look at the health disparities has a lot to do not just with the race and ethnicity of a person, but also, more importantly, I should say, where they live. So we still, to some degree, see healthcare that is based on the quality of care that a person receives in a particular location, depending on the location that a person lives. And there's a lot of history that leads to the actual residential area in which a number of communities end up in. So it's an interesting intermixing of not only the healthcare system, but really telling the story of social infrastructure and how social infrastructure has interacted with minority communities.
You know, Dr. Graham, you mentioned a few minutes ago that the Affordable Care Act lays out some opportunities to improve health outcomes, but specifically requires that the Secretary of Health make sure that federally supported health surveys collect data on race, ethnicity, sex, primary language, and disability status. But the new rules that HHS put forward require federal agencies collect health information at a much higher, more specific standard. And I think in hope that you'll better understand the significant health issues in specific populations. Tell us about your hope of what you'll learn from the enhanced data and how do you envision it being used to improve health outcomes and reduce health disparities.
Sure. So as you just pointed out, we just put out our proposed standards for data collection around race, ethnicity, primary language, sex, and disability status. And on the race, ethnicity portion, previously in the 1990s, Office of Management and Budget, OMB, had put out a series of standards for race and ethnicity. And over the past couple of years, even prior to those standards, the country has become more and more and more diversified. So it means that when we say Asian American, there is a lot of differences between the Hmong population and the Japanese population, great differences between the Vietnamese population and the Korean population. When we say Hispanic and Latino, in terms of ethnicity, there are differences in terms of health outcomes between Puerto Rican populations and Cuban American populations. So they're all differences even within categories. So what we're trying to do with these new standards is building on the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget criteria that was put forward in the mid-1990s, is to further disaggregate data for race and ethnicity. So when you look at when we talk about Asian Americans, we go into talking about Korean Americans, Vietnamese Americans, and other sub-segments of the Asian American community. Similarly, when you look at the Hispanic community, we also, again, going to looking at different sub-segments of the community. So really what we're trying to do is to further and further disaggregate data on race, ethnicity, as well as looking at this issue of getting more definition around the primary language that people speak. So we are calling that, we're hoping that would be the new baseline, but certainly we hope and expect that there are many other surveys and data collection activities that will go into more detail and granularity than even just those surveys.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Garth Graham, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Graham, not so long ago, the Commonwealth Fund issued a report and made a bold statement based on their research that a high-performance health system can markedly reduce or even eliminate disparities in health and healthcare. We still see some disparities in health, such as the persistent gap in birth outcomes for African-American women, for instance, even when the gains have been made in income and education and in access to health care. Tell us a little bit about the state of research in this area on health care disparities, but also on health outcome disparities, even when other factors seem to have improved for the better.
Sure. You know, the statistics around infant mortality in minority communities really point to the complexity of the problem in terms of just all the different factors that go into the health outcomes in minority populations. So you're right that when we look on that infant mortality rate from comparing African-American women to the rest of the general population, in many cases, the infant mortality rate, which is the rate at which babies die within the first year of life, for babies of African-American women who have a graduate degree, their infant mortality rate is still higher than other women from the majority community who have not graduated high school. So we see those disparities that still persist even when you, for lack of a better terminology, control for socioeconomic status. So what does that mean in terms of moving forward? Well, it means, one, that there is no simplistic way to deal with the issue of health disparities. You can't just categorize it as a socioeconomic status issue and just kind of chalk it up to that. There are other issues that go beyond that, and certainly access to care is an issue. Certainly understanding how we interact with all the different, for lack of a better terminology, social determinants of health, those things outside just health, the definition of health, so talking about jobs and education, other kinds of things, and how those things interact. And one of the interesting things around the infant mortality data is there is some data about the role of stress and just how the role of stress in minority communities plays a role in terms of those infant mortality numbers. So, you know, it's really a multifactorial kind of issue. But as we move to the high-performing healthcare system that not only the Commonwealth Fund, but all of us involved in health and healthcare would like to see happen, I think it's going to be important to keep the patient at the center of that and understand all the different dynamics that the patients go through.
Dr. Graham, you know, Margaret and I have both been involved in the healthcare movement for quite a time, and I think it's axiomatic in our field that having health insurance and having access to healthcare is fundamental to reducing and eliminating health disparities. Now, the Affordable Care Act speaks to that for all Americans, but what elements of the health reform bill specifically address health disparities, either in terms of access or innovation or research or training? So, and have any of those elements been implemented to date? Can you let our listeners give them a little look at the waterfront?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. So as you pointed out, the insurance part of it has been the part that has gotten the most attention. And certainly we are trying to improve the health system and access to the health system by providing various options for improved access, whether that be through strengthening Medicaid, as well as other things like the pre-existing condition insurance plan and other kinds of plans like that to increase access to care. But you're right, they're actually, the word health disparities is mentioned numerous times across the Affordable Care Act, not just in the area of the insurance provision. And to give you kind of a preview, we talked about one of those things in terms of improving data on minority populations, and that's certainly one aspect. Also, it does a number of things to improve the infrastructure of how the Department of Health and Human Services deals with health disparities. It puts in health disparities infrastructure into the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It puts in place health disparities infrastructure in a number of different ages, from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration to the Food and Drug Administration to a number of places to have specific foci in those agencies that deal with health disparities. It goes beyond that to also directing the department to put more of an emphasis on cultural competency and the things that we do around cultural competency to help improve access to cultural competency curricula and things like that. So these are all things that have either been implemented or are in the process of being implemented. So it's really a transformative time period. But I think it's also important to understand that the Affordable Care Act is not the end-all, be-all for all things health disparities mm-hmm. related.
Good
and
point.
There will need to be ongoing and continued efforts outside of that. It's certainly a step forward, but is not the panacea for the reduction of health disparities.
Well, you know, Dr. Graham, one of the certainly the hallmarks of everybody at HHS these days seems to be a commitment to innovation and to strategic thinking. And certainly inserting those Centers for Health Disparity within all the different agencies is a great step forward. But on the innovation front, I know I've heard you speak, I think, about the interest within your area of looking at community health workers,
yes.
Something people don't generally think of as part of the traditional healthcare system, although in many parts of the country, that's a very proven model. Tell us a little bit about why that rises to the level of an innovation that you'd like to see put forth and what it promises to offer in the area of reducing or eliminating health disparities.
Sure. So, you know, community health workers have been, quite frankly, part of the community for a long time. I think the healthcare system is just catching up to figuring out how do we utilize those kinds of individuals. There have been people in communities that have been the go-to person for understanding how you navigate systems and for understanding all kinds of things about local communities. And so, you know, that's been in place historically in a number of underserved communities. You kind of have that one person who can help people understand what it is they need to do. What we're finding more and more is that the incorporation of those kinds of individuals into the healthcare system, into healthcare teams, allows us to be able to reach folks in a number of different ways and allows us to interact with the community like never before. So as part of our departmental strategic plan around health disparities, we have put a big emphasis on community health workers. In the Latino community, they're referred to as promotores. And in fact, Our secretary, Secretary Sebelius, just announced a promotores initiative that we're doing. She announced it about 2 or 3 weeks ago. And the long and short of it is, what we're trying to say is the department is going to be funding as well as working with and forming partnership with community health workers / promotores at a number of different levels. And the goal there really is to come up with new and innovative ways to reach people and understand that in many ways, communities have already defined how they interact with each other, and it's about the healthcare system interacting with communities at the grassroots level.
Well, I think that's exciting work, and certainly I think it flies in the face of most people's thinking that the federal government is here to help, but it's not here to help at a local level, and you've really transformed that with your initiatives there. Pull the thread a little, if you will, on how you're using social media. I think so many of the younger people today are texting, they're on Facebook, on Twitter, and I'm probably dating myself because there are probably newer things I should be saying here already. But talk to us a little bit about how you start to conceptualize this local commitment using those outlets.
Sure. So, you know, in 1999, the Department of Commerce released a study looking at how minority communities interact with technology. And it was one of those initial reports to really highlight the issue of a digital divide. What's interesting, if you look over the past 9 or 10 years, that digital divide, though still present, is closing. Mm-hmm. The Pew Research, the Pew Hispanic Research folks published some recent data showing that Hispanic Americans, as well as we see in other minority communities too, are utilizing broadband technology, mobile phone technology, all kinds of those technology at a faster rate compared to the general population. So that means that even though the divide exists, the actual rate of the divide is closing because people are starting to utilize these technologies as they become cheaper and cheaper. So with that being said and done, you know, it's about us utilizing these methodologies as much as other people are utilizing them appropriately.
Today, we've been speaking with Dr. Garth Graham, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Graham, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations today.
Thank you for having me.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. Healthcare telephone helplines exist in countries throughout the developed and developing world. They're designed to provide healthcare triage services, counseling, and information about locating a provider or hospital. Some are set up to respond to national emergencies or to address a specific issue, like reproductive health and family planning. In low- and middle-income countries, these types of helplines have been recognized recently for reducing health system barriers. For example, in the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh, the government provides a 24-hour health helpline. It's available to anyone in the state of 80 million inhabitants, and it offers the standard triage, counseling, and medical referral services. The call center gets roughly 50,000 calls per day. About half of the calls come through the 104 Health Advice Helpline, and the other half through the 104 Mobile. By making the service available free, more people have access to at least some form of health care. But there's a downside. The government can decide to end the contract. And this is exactly what happened with the Healthline in Andhra Pradesh recently. After operating for about 5 years, the government decided in late June that it would not renew its contract with the Health Management and Research Institute, which operates the Healthline. According to Gina Lagomarsino from the Center for Health Market Innovations, which is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, a big contract between a government and a private organization always presents challenges, especially in places like India, where governments can change and seek to develop their own program. There can also be allegations of corruption. Lagomarsino says this model, where the government is paying, is different from a lot of other health helplines that are cropping up in other parts of the world.
Medi-Cal, the program in Mexico that also offers health advice over the phone, is actually paid by a monthly subscription fee. And then there are other programs in other parts of the world, such as Teledoctor in Pakistan, that are actually a per-minute charge using the mobile phone bill as a way to charge.
The small fee is normally far below the market price for a doctor's visit. As other states in India look to replicate the health helpline they've heard about in Andhra Pradesh, it's uncertain if they will venture away from a government contract and opt for a more profit-making enterprise.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network, and the Real Life Survival Guide is next.